Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend, three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Did you notice? Summer officially started this weekend. School's out on Thursday in New York City. It's been out for a while in a lot of other places in the area. Time to get serious about summer reading. But is that a contradiction in terms? Getting serious about summer reading? Do you tend to lighter fare when the sun is shining and the temperature is warm? Joining me to talk about summer books, among other things, including soccer, by the way, is an author with a horse in this game. Elizabeth Gilbert's latest novel, The Signature of All Things, is just out in paperback. You may know her from that book or that other one, Eat, Pray, Love. That was part book, part opernomenon. She's provided us with a bit of her summer reading list. Share your own on our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show and see what we've posted there from Elizabeth Gilbert. Welcome back to WNYC. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. Brian, did you just invent the portmanteau opernomenon?
One of my producers fed me that little word. Do you like it?
I like it. I like it. It works. Nice to see you. How are you?
Nice to see you. I'm good. And it's great to see you face to face in the studio. And you generously sent us two lists, books you want to read this summer and some past favorites.
Yeah.
And I'd say neither list contains your typical beach read, by which I mean something in the Jacqueline Suzanne school of pulpy trash. What makes a perfect summer book for you?
For me, my association with perfect summer books are big, juicy, complex, epic novels, because I feel like you need the languid, sort of sweaty hours of summer to get yourself through those great books. It's weird because the other great time to read those is, of course, in the dead of winter when it's dark at 3 p.m. But I like to enjoy summer tackling like big, nutritious books.
And so let's dive right in here.
Yeah.
And these are all novels, except one on your list of books to read this summer, which is not in that exception, is the late theater director Moss Hart's memoir, Act One.
Right. Right, which I expect probably will read like a novel because from what I know about him, his life sort of read like a novel. And that's a little bit of homework for me, too, because I'm working on a novel about New York City theater in the 1940s. And it feels like you can't even begin to approach that subject without having read Act One, which I think everybody universally agrees is the best theater memoir of all time. So that's on my list.
So let's go through a few of these.
Yeah.
Besides Act One, All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr.
And to be fair, I'm halfway through it. When I sent you this list, I had, I was just beginning it, and I can't stay away from it. It is the perfect summer novel, World War II, complex, beautiful, interconnected stories of a young French girl and a young German boy.
Oh, yeah,
it's wonderful.
A blind French girl and a German boy,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Occupied France.
It's really, really exquisite. And it's also, it sort of intersects in a way with my interests because it's about science and the natural world as well. So it's these lives of people who are very fascinated with natural philosophy who are caught up in war.
Another one, The Flamethrowers by Rachel Kushner.
Just started that as well. I tend to be always reading about seven books at the same time. I don't know if everyone else has that habit. It is. Until one hooks me and then, I'm monogamous to it. And then I go back to my party ways of having six or seven on my bedside table.
I've done that too. I've gone on vacation with like three or four novels and read the first, even as little as 10, 15 pages of each.
Yeah.
And then, okay, which is really my read for these 2 weeks?
It's like speed dating. you have to sort of meet them all in the first pages and then see who grabs you. So I think The Flamethrowers is going to be great. I've heard, obviously it was a huge hit last year, and I've heard great things about it.
Set in the mid-70s, its narrator, a woman in her early 20s, has come to New York to turn her fascination with motorcycles into an art career, according to the blurb that I've read. I have not read this book, but that sounds like a fun 1970s confection.
Yeah, it is. Although it doesn't read like a confection. It's intense. It's about weirdly, it's about motorcycles and avant-garde art and terrorism. And I think it's a bit of a heavy beach read, but I'm up for it.
And listeners, share your summer reading list with Elizabeth Gilbert, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And, of course, if you want to talk to her about her own books, including The Signature of All Things, just out in paperback, or Eat, Pray, Love, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Come on in. The summer read waters are fine. Also on your list for this summer, Parrot and Olivier in America by Peter Carey. It's a few years old.
It is. It's a reward book for me because it's a book that I wasn't able to read over. I love Peter Carey. And there are certain books when you're writing a novel that you can't read because they're too similar to what you're working on. So for the 4 years that I spent reading The Signature of All Things, that has been sitting unwrapped by my bedside table because it is also a little bit about naturalism, about 18th and 19th century exploration in America. It was just, I knew that it would be influencing me in the wrong ways. And so now that I've put my own period novel away, I'm allowed to dive into
it's like
Peter Carey.
It's like fictionalized De Tocqueville, isn't it?
Yeah. Of course. What else would you want to read for the summer? And I know that the—
It's a fascinating, again, it's another one I haven't read, but it's a fascinating premise.
I will read anything that Peter Carey writes, one, and two, it is a fascinating premise. And the secondary character, the one who's not based on De Tocqueville, is an engraver of naturalist prints, which is similar to a character in my novel. Again, why I couldn't read it before and why I'm allowed to now.
But why would that have gotten in the way of writing Signature? Why wouldn't you want to be consuming, you know, lots of input about that period if that's what you were immersing yourself
in? I did want to, and I did end up doing that. It's more important for me to read books from that period than books about that period, and particularly so with novels, because you don't want to even accidentally, I mean, you certainly don't want to intentionally plagiarize, but you don't want to accidentally plagiarize, and you also don't want to fall off your game, especially with a master like Peter Carey, where you just, you know, a few chapters in, you're likely to think, why am I even trying to play in this playing field that others have done so well? So I think it's better to just avoid it.
I could see where it would potentially affect your writing process. And this happens in journalism, too, in nonfiction, where you think you're onto a great idea, you're pursuing it, it's your idea, it's original, you're into it, and then you discover there's something similar going on, and you get off your inner voice.
Yeah.
Because you just don't want to be competing with somebody, or you don't want to be on the same track that somebody else who you might respect is on.
And so
it throws you off yourself.
It does. And ideas are very disloyal. just because you love your idea doesn't mean that it's necessarily loyal to you. And so I do think you have to be careful to stay away from other people who are on the same track.
And you're listening to WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJO 90.3 Toms River, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJP 88.5 Sussex, New York and New Jersey Public Radio. Brian Lehrer along with Elizabeth Gilbert. And let's take a phone call. Sherry in the West Village, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Is this for Carrie?
Yeah.
Okay. First of all, I'm a big fan of Elizabeth Gilbert's fiction in particular, and I think that summertime is a time for rereading, too. So I'd like to recommend her first novel, Stern Men, which is a very, to use the cliche, wise and witty, but there's a reason it's a cliche. It's a wise and witty first a novel set off the coast of Maine with a doughty young heroine and, of course, not a few lobsters. And going back to the last century, I'm going to reread her first book of short stories, Pilgrims. So I recommend them to everyone, and especially to those who've stuck with her nonfiction.
Are you her publicist?
Or my mom?
No. We've never met. I've never spoken to her, but I've spoken of her.
That's so sweet. So if you're such a fan, do you want to ask Elizabeth anything?
Well, actually, I'd just like to sort of stick with her books.
Aww.
I'm looking forward
to
what else she has to say over the course of this conversation, of course, but it's time for me to cede to the next caller.
Thank you very much.
What a completely and thoroughly wonderful person. Thank you. I really appreciate that.
So now I have to find somebody who's going to beat you up.
that will not be hard, Brian.
I don't think that will be easy. Sherry in Dobbs Ferry, you're on WNYC. Hello.
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 Hi, I have downloaded the entire George R. R. Martin saga into my Kindle, all five books, and it's just amazing, just chewy stuff. It's all the things that the Game of Thrones is based on.
Mm-hmm. Saga of Fire and Ice.
Yes. Yes.
And did your Kindle explode? Isn't that about cumulatively 500,000 pages?
almost. My partner and some friends of varied ages and backgrounds loved it,
yeah.
And I got tired of fighting it. So,
oh, don't fight it. No, I haven't read them myself, only because I don't want to. This is so backwards, but I don't want any spoilers for the show that I am completely obsessed with, of Game of Thrones.
I haven't seen the show.
Oh.
I refuse to watch it, and I duck and dodge TV headlines and newspapers and
Why do you refuse to watch it? If you're into George R. R. Martin.
In my experience, books that I like and books that I love that have been made for the most part into movies or TV series usually disappoint me.
Thank you very much.
You haven't seen the dragons yet, though.
And I take it you haven't seen the finale of the season yet of Game of Thrones.
I most certainly have.
Oh, I thought you were worried about
a
spoiler.
No, I don't read the books because I don't want to spoil this television show, which makes me sound like the most unliterary person in the entire world. Only because I started
with
the show.
That's very sophisticated.
I think it's kind of the opposite of sophisticated.
Well, it's sophisticated gamesmanship.
Yeah, it is. It is. But I'm so terrified to find out who dies that I have to stay away from the books till the show's over, which will be 20 years from now.
A listener wrote in to suggest a book called We Were Liars by E. Lockhart. She's saving it for a trip to Mexico. It's a book about a family at their summer house, and it's also a young adult novel. Is summertime a good time to regress a little and catch up on, you know, I don't even know if I can call young adult novels regression anymore because they tend to be so dystopian like The Hunger Games.
Yeah, they're not exactly escapist, except for that the people are usually escaping some horrible, grisly, bloody death in those novels. But I will say that it is a time. There are certain novels that you read in certain summers of your life that I think will always stay with you. And so there'll be a sort of a novel of each summer. And a couple years ago, I read a book called The Summer Book, which has the perfect title for summer reading, by Tove Jansson, who wrote the Moomin children's books. It's a sort of thinly disguised fictional memoirish book about a young girl, 6-year-old girl, on a small idyllic island in the Gulf of Finland, translated from Swedish. It is the most exquisite, nostalgic, perfect. You can almost feel the northern light of summer in Scandinavia. It is such a perfect book.
Called The Summer Book.
The Summer Book. In case they haven't pointed out clearly enough what a perfect summer book it is.
What the marketing trick was in the title of the name. That's like from the early 70s, right?
Yeah, that's a classic. It's beautiful.
So the travel in that listener's suggestion that she's saving it for a trip to Mexico, the mm-hmm. We Were Liars. Are there books that you save for travel, books, say, with a plucky heroine who travels off to far lands, like maybe The Signature of All Things?
Well, that, of course, would be a lovely book to save for travel and is about travel. You want a big, juicy, long airplane novel, I think. And my greatest fear, okay, I have bigger fears than this existentially, but literally my greatest fear has been to be trapped without a big book when traveling, which is why I've embraced reading online and reading electronically, even though it's a purist.
What's your device of choice?
I read on my iPad, yeah.
I like the iPad. It's bigger than the Kindle.
Well, I used to travel. I mean, I remember going to visit my husband when he was living in Indonesia. I went for 2 months and I brought one carry-on with my clothes and a giant suitcase full of books because of the fear of being stranded with nothing to read. That's a true terror for me. So the Kindle and the iPad have saved that.
So this conflicts with the purist streak in you?
Whatever is left or ever existed in a purist streak. Yeah, definitely.
And travel is such an integral part of Eat, Pray, Love, too, especially your trip to India. Do you see a difference between travel and tourism?
You know, I'm going to not be a purist here. Purist is, of course, a polite word for a snob, and I think I sometimes get I sometimes get offended by people drawing that line and very archly saying, I'm not a tourist, I'm a traveler. I feel like there's an arrogance in it because nobody can say what somebody is getting out of a voyage. And I know, for instance, that my mother, who travels every year with her sister-in-law, and they go away for 2 weeks and they have these great adventures. And by any definition, they're tourists, but they're women in their 70s who waited their whole lives to travel. This is the allotted time that they have. They've been to Turkey, to Costa Rica, to Peru. They've done these really wonderful, adventurous things. And I feel like defending their honor and saying, you know, they've got lives that they have to hold up their contracts to, and this is their moment to see what they can of the world in the time that they've got.
That's very nice. That's very sweet, actually. But I think that travel has played a deeper role for you in your life than that, at least as reflected by your writing. What would you say about travel and the role that it has played in your inner life as well as your exploration of the world?
I kind of don't know who or what I would be without it. The first trip I ever took in my life was when I was 16 years old. I went to the Soviet Union with money that I had saved from years of babysitting. And I went for 10 days on a peace exchange trip with Russian students. It was in the beginning of Gorbachev's reign, and there was this sort of crack, you know, where you could get in. And I was eager to be one of the first people in. And I was a junior in high school in a small town in Connecticut. But I really wanted to be as far away as I could and in the most interesting places that I could be in. I remember somebody telling me once when I was in my 20s, it's a good thing you're doing this now because you won't have the chance to do it when you're older. And I remember thinking, that makes sense. I understand your logic. However, I actually think I will always be doing this, and it's the case that I remain a traveler.
And so has your relationship with travel changed since then? Does it play a different role, again, in your inner life as well as your curiosity about the world? Since you've left your 20s?
No. to be perfectly honest, I don't think it's changed since I was 16 and went to the Soviet Union for the first time. There's somebody asked me in an interview the other day the strangest question, what's your favorite sound? And I said the hum of a transcontinental or transatlantic airplane in the middle of the night. I don't think there's anything more soothing to me. It's this wonderful sense that no one can reach you, that you're on your way to something unexpected and unknown. And I've never gotten over my adolescent excitement about it.
We are comparing notes on summer reading lists and travel and other things with Elizabeth Gilbert, whose book, The Signature of All Things, is just out in paperback, and who is, of course, also the author of Eat, Pray, Love, among other books. For your curiosity, before we get back to the phones, there are, a couple of events. Elizabeth Gilbert will be in conversation with Rebecca Mead tonight at St. Joseph's College on Clinton between DeKalb and Willoughby in Brooklyn at 7:30 tonight at St. Joseph's College. And tomorrow night, Ridgewood Public Library, that's Ridgewood, New Jersey, not Ridgewood, Queens. Don't go there. The Signature of All Things. Is out in paperback today, and I guess that's why you're doing some public appearances at this particular moment, right?
Yeah, of course.
And Abby in Plainview, you're on WNYC with Elizabeth Gilbert. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Sure. I highly recommend Reed Farrell Coleman's The Hollow Girl. It's the last in his Mo Prager detective series, but you don't have to have read all the other books to enjoy it. His stories are beautifully layered. The characters, every character is fleshed out and sympathetic and intelligent. He lives here on Long Island, actually, and his stories are woven with Coney Island and Brooklyn and Long Island. And it's just a wonderful read because it's not only a great mystery story, it's got fabulous humor in it as well.
Thank you very much. Here's another recommendation of a book with summer in the title from Tony in Manhattan. Tony, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
Sure can.
Oh, hi. How are you? I'm calling to recommend actually a book that I read a rave on NPR about on the NPR website a while ago called The Summer Prince by Alaya Dawn Johnson. And Alaya is A-L-A-Y-A. And it's really a beautiful book, and it's set in a future post-apocalyptic Brazil. And it's loaded with just fascinating kind of art things and political things. And is your guest familiar with Elia's work? This is her fifth or sixth book.
I'm not, and I'm actually going to ask you if this Summer Prince is that Prince like the heir to the throne, or Prince like a lithograph? Is it
Heir to the Throne.
Oh, okay. Okay, cool.
The summer prince.
Every 5 years, there's a summer prince is chosen and then sacrificed. Anyway, the imagery in the book is just beautiful, and it really just brings you into a completely other world.
Cool.
I'm only halfway through it now, I have to say, but I love it.
Thank you. You have roused our guest curiosity.
I just wrote it down. I'll read anything about Brazil.
Yeah,
even post-apocalyptic Brazil.
Elia John Johnson.
Thank you so much.
Tony, thank you very much. Let's see. Post-apocalyptic Brazil. Would that be Brazil after the U.S. beats them in the World Cup? Looks like you could go into sports commentary, Elizabeth Gilbert, because at Gilbert Liz is pretty much live tweeting the games from what we've seen.
I know. I was saying this morning to a friend, I think I'm losing my spiritual seeking Twitter follow, because all I'm doing is live tweeting World Cup games pretty much around the clock. I'm hoarse from cheering on. How about that Portugal-U.S. game the other day?
Kick in the gut.
I feel like I haven't even picked my jaw up from that. That was devastating.
And yet if it went any other way and the outcome was the same, a draw.
Yeah.
People would have been like, yeah.
Well, I still feel like, I think part of the joy of watching this World Cup is that this is, I think, quite literally the only instance in the world in which the United States is a scrappy little underdog. And there's something really fun about being able to, unabashedly cheer on the United States without sounding sort of fascistic.
I love that take on it.
So it's really fun to be like, oh, those are our kids, our boys, you know. It's lovely.
Also, did you see the ratings that came out yesterday for that game? 25 million homes or viewers, I forget what exactly they measure, but it was compared to 15 million for each game of the World Series last year.
What?
So soccer has arrived.
Hello, America's pastime.
Exactly.
That's awesome.
At least once every 4 years.
Oh, that's so great. No, I've been having a tremendous amount of fun tweeting the games. It's been great.
Rita in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Elizabeth Gilbert. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to know, about Guru Mai and how she influenced you, how you met her, because you have, mentioned her. So I was just curious.
This is a reference to the particular guru who's the spiritual head of the ashram that I went to in India.
Yes.
I have never actually met her in person. I've only studied at her ashram when she was not in residence. But of course, I feel a great closeness to her and to her wisdom.
And what do you do when you're at the ashram?
You meditate most of the waking hours of the day. Those waking hours beginning at about 4 o'clock in the morning, and that's really about it. It's intense. It's sort of boot camp for self, for introspection. It's not a spa. It's not a relaxing experience, but it's a pivotal one.
How do you get confronted in meditation?
Well, if you're like me, and you probably are because you're a human being, your mind is probably a very bad neighborhood that you wouldn't want to walk around in alone at night. And most of us spend our lives trying to dodge that neighborhood. And the difference between regular living and meditative thinking is that you're actually looking at that bravely and courageously and consistently. And it's shocking.
But I think that's different than the impression that a lot of people have of meditation, which is that you get taught to push thoughts away and try to empty the mind and not have it be about the content of your life or the content of your thoughts while you're meditating. Do you do a different kind of meditation than that?
No, I do that. I aim for that. But I don't have much luck emptying my mind. And what I've learned over the years in my meditation practice is that I do better watching it in a detached way than emptying it. I've never had this sort of perfectly scrubbed, clean Zen mind that we all aspire to. But I have learned how to not get involved with the drama of my own thinking. And that's more what my meditation is. It's like a subway train that arrives at a station. You don't get on it.
And then do you find that after you've done a retreat like that, that you can apply whatever insights or emotions you've had or spiritual cleansing, however you want to describe it, to your day-to-day life, to real relationships in the real world? Is it relevant enough to that to sit and meditate at an ashram?
I think if it isn't, then it's not worth the time or investment, because my feeling is that any spiritual practice that doesn't actually make the difficulties of your daily life easier and your relationships more manageable is worthless. You know, I mean, you don't just do it, because it looks good, right? Like, you do it because you're trying to find strategies and tactics for managing the complexity of being a human being. So it does seem to help. You know, I'm far from a master, but I'm better off than I used to be.
Lisa in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Elizabeth Gilbert. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share with Elizabeth that I read your book, Eat, Pray, Love, and it just had such an impact on me. I was in a bad marriage, 26-year bad marriage, and I read it and took a trip to Italy with this man and just took the book with me just to help jar my memory of all the Italian scenery and imagery that you had so beautifully described. And while I read it, while I was there and had some downtime and some real contemplative time with him, I just realized I had to leave him.
And oh my goodness.
It was when I got back, I moved out. And it was such a pivotal tool for me in examining a relationship that really was very damaging. And I just wanted to thank you. It was really a pivotal time in my life.
Wow.
And a pivotal tool.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I'm sorry. I mean, I know that was not an easy thing for you to have gone through, and I'm happy you've come out safely on the other side.
It's a good thing. It's a really good thing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Lisa, thanks. What's it like to have that kind of influence on people's, the most intimate part of people's lives after you kind of sat in your room and wrote words on a page?
It's very touching, and it doesn't stop being touching for me. You know, it's been almost 10 years now since Eat, Pray, Love came out, and it's not like I ever get to a point where I'm jaded to a response like that. I think especially because of how surprising it is to discover again and again that there are so many women in particular who really never did get the memo that their lives belong to themselves. And I think it's so easy for women who are good at being good to live in imitation of somebody else's life better than, the messy, awkward reality of their own. And if my book did nothing else than give people permission to embark on their own journeys, whatever that might be, and it doesn't necessarily have to be that everybody has to get divorced and move to India, but there does come a point where you have your own reckoning, and I'm happy that the book empowered people to have those reckonings.
And I see you're going on tour with Oprah this fall, along with some of her other regulars.
Yeah.
Is that the kind of thing you'll be focusing on?
Yeah, completely. And what I like about, first of all, what I like about going on tour with Oprah is that Oprah wants me to go on tour with her, which is amazing. But what I love about this particular venue, this possibility of this 8-city tour, is that I can be so unabashedly and unironically talking about what I really care about, and what I really, really care about are women's journeys and women's lives and letting people find the treasures that are hidden within them and giving them the permission slip from the principal's office that they somehow never got, that they are allowed to ask these questions and go on these journeys.
Before you go, can I pluck you on an issue? You mentioned reading on your devices.
Yeah.
Do you have a take on the Hachette versus Amazon standoff and the implications for writing?
Too soon to tell. To quote, who is the Chinese premier who said that when they asked him what he thought the effect of the French Revolution was on world history in the 1950s? He said, too soon to tell. I feel that way about everything that's happening in the book and publishing world right now. It's anybody who claims to have a hook on this and to understand exactly what's going or where we're going to be in 10 years, much less 20 or even next month, is just reading tea leaves, because I don't think anybody has the first idea what's going on.
But your relationship with your publisher doesn't suggest that if Amazon becomes the publisher and eliminates the publishing industry as kind of the middleman, that isn't going to be to the detriment of literature?
The detriment of literature is a song that people have been singing for centuries. And I have trouble jumping on board that every time there's a new catastrophe. We are still here. And it's not like before the internet and before Amazon back in 1987, when I was telling people that I wanted to be a writer, they were like, well, that's a great, safe business career to go into, because that's on the up and up. You know, it's never been on the up and up. It's only ever been on the down and down. And yet, we tell stories. People want our stories. I want to read. I want to write. So do you. We're still here. Too soon to bang the gong yet.
All right. Let's finish up with a tweet that we just got from writer Rosie Schapp, who tweets, at Gilbert Liz, said on at Brian Lehrer, she thinks she may have lost followers because of her World Cup tweeting. She's gained at least one new one.
Oh, that's lovely. See you this afternoon.
That's right. And Thursday afternoon, at noon. You're tweeting the other countries' games, too?
I'm tweeting all the games.
Really?
I'm equally interested in all of them. The problem is I'm going on book tour, so I just need to call FIFA and ask them if they can just postpone for a week. Yeah, just for a week. I don't think it'll be a problem.
Did you get into soccer so much because you've traveled the world so much?
Well, one of my greatest experiences when I was living in Italy was going to soccer games with my friend Luca. And I actually write about it in Eat, Pray, Love, including a long transcript of all the curses that I learned in soccer games. And then, of course, I'm married to a Brazilian. So it's not like he's doing anything else for the next 2 weeks.
And there we leave it. We have information on our webpage about getting tickets to Elizabeth Gilbert's conversation with Rebecca Mead tonight at St. Joseph's College on Clinton between DeKalb and Willoughby in Brooklyn at 7:30, and tomorrow night's event at the Ridgewood Public Library in Ridgewood, New Jersey. The Signature of All Things is out in paperback today, and this has been such a joy. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian. It's been a pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Oh, by the way, we also have the summer reading list that Elizabeth Gilbert provided us. Two, really, ones that she wants to read this summer and some of her favorites from past summers also on our page. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. The crowd singing We Shall Overcome on August 7th, 1964, inside a church in Meridian, Mississippi, at the funeral of James Chaney, the civil rights worker who was killed along with Andrew Goodman and Michael Schwerner during Mississippi's so-called Freedom Summer. Chaney, Goodman, and Schwerner had disappeared 6 weeks earlier, 50 years ago yesterday, June 22, 1964. It was an event that galvanized the nation's attention to the efforts of volunteers in Mississippi, many young white Northerners, and to the plight of black residents of the South. As we mark the 50th anniversary of their death and the work done by all the volunteers who traveled to Mississippi that summer, we are joined by Tufts historian Peniel Joseph, author of Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama. Hi, Peniel. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian.
And listeners, did you take part in the Freedom Summer? Call in with your oral histories, 212-433-WNYC. Why did you go, especially if you were a Northerner? Was your safety in danger at moments in particular that you recall? What else do you remember? When you look back, what are the first things that come to your mind even today? Your Freedom Summer oral histories, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Peniel, for people who don't know the history, the effort was technically a voter registration drive, correct?
Well, yeah, it was a voter registration drive, but technically, since there was no Voting Rights Act and that wouldn't be passed till the next year, what it was something to galvanize voter interest and provide voter education. So by the end of that summer, there's going to be over 55,000 people who fill out freedom registration ballots to prove to the federal government and the state of Mississippi that there are tens of thousands of people in Mississippi, black people, who want to vote but have been denied the right to vote.
Here is a clip, and we have some historical audio footage to play throughout this segment, of Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee leader Bob Moses, a main organizer of Freedom Summer, talking about the efforts.
We hope to send into Mississippi this summer upwards of 1,000 teachers, ministers, lawyers, and students from all around the country who will engage in a program designed to open up Mississippi to the country.
And he refers to ministers, lawyers, students. Who are these volunteers?
Well, there's going to be really over 800-900 volunteers who come from all over the United States. Predominantly, they're going to be student volunteers. And these are undergraduate students at places like City University of New York and New York City, everywhere from Columbia, NYU, Swarthmore, Tufts, Berkeley, who come down. And really, when we think about what was going on in the early 60s, white activists like Tom Hayden and Casey Hayden, they thought of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, as the cutting edge of a human rights movement that was happening globally. So many students by early 63, 64 wanted to participate in the movement. Now, black activists like Bob Moses and Stokely Carmichael, some were concerned that if you brought a bunch of white students in, what would it mean for the local indigenous population? Moses argued it was going to get more attention, much needed attention, for the work that SNCC was doing since 1961 in Macomb, Mississippi, to try to register African Americans to vote.
And here's more historical audio, courtesy of NBC News. Reverend Bruce Hansen of the National Council of Churches from 1964, talking to NBC about what the volunteers were told before they headed down.
We just try in every conceivable way to make people realize that they'd be jeopardizing themselves and the project unless they're thoroughly convinced that they want to go and work in the state, even in the face of such events as these.
And I read, Peniel, that many volunteers were turned down. So there was a concerted effort to make sure that the people going into Mississippi were well trained and knew what they were getting themselves into, correct?
Absolutely. They wanted to weed out anybody who was just into adventure, anybody who was just really a gadfly. They did weeks of training at the Western College for Women in Ohio, and that's where most of the volunteers actually heard that Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman were missing on June 22nd, even though they go missing the evening of June 21st. So they really got a predominantly focused group of white student activists. But the interesting thing, Brian, is that those hundreds of students would really transform the movement. And in a sense, they were really transformed themselves. Many wrote memoirs about their time in Mississippi and how they felt. Many wrote letters back to their parents, and they were really shocked at the racism, the poverty in Mississippi. So it was an incredible educational tool for them, but they spread the word nationally as well.
You mentioned training. What kind of training would they receive for this kind of effort?
Well, the training was primarily on a few different things. One was a training in terms of nonviolence and the fact that if they were harassed or if they were at demonstrations or picket lines, how to protect themselves if they were going to be physically abused. But they were also trained in the mores of the South, meaning that, boys and girls were trained to these young men and women that they shouldn't be in interracial groups together, in the sense of if there were any kind of romantic attachments, that could not be done in the light of day because of how dangerous that would be. They were trained in the sense of how to speak to indigenous black locals, many of whom would not want to make eye contact with white students, many of whom would say yes to whatever any white person said because they feared any kind of reprisals. So they were trained in terms of the lay of the land on what could and could not be done by the student workers.
You're listening to WNYC FM HD in AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio. As we remember the Freedom Summer 50 years ago, part of the series that Tufts University historian Peniel Joseph is doing with us that really began last year and will run into next year, about the 50th anniversaries of some of the landmark moments in the civil rights movement. And this includes your oral histories in each case. So did you participate in Freedom Summer in 1964? Or did your parents and they told you about it? Or anyone you know? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Michael in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling in.
Oh, thank you, Brian. I'm glad to be here. I called in because I was a Yale junior in 1964, and the SNCC leaders had come to Yale and were trying to recruit. I wanted to go, but I had to work because I was a scholarship student. So I wangled myself to get to be like a cub reporter for the Boston Globe, and I went out to that training session in Ohio. And by the way, one of the things they were trained were not to respond. They trained them, you know, if they fell down, then the SNCC people would pretend to kick them and all kinds of things, too, so that they wouldn't fight back and to protect their heads and their vital organs from attack. But it was an exciting, dramatic, fun, scary as hell summer. I went down there with a fellow from Life and a photographer, Steve Shapiro, who I think is still active, and we got to Ruleville, to the home of Fannie Lou Hamer, who was cutting her husband's hair in the shade of a pecan tree. But then we heard that three kids had been missing from Philadelphia. No one had heard of Philadelphia, Mississippi. It was way over by the Alabama border. But we went over there, and they were missing. And the scariest thing, Brian, was that I was there when they found the car, the Mickey Schwerner's car.
Really?
It had been burned out. But what I try to communicate is it was like they poured gasoline and burned it. But it looked like an angel of hell had come and visited that car.
Michael, thank you very much for your memories. I appreciate you calling up. And let's go to another caller, Mary in Newark. Mary, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. And I have a story to tell, but before that, I just wanted to mention about training, that those of us who were in Ohio being trained for freedom schools had a huge reading list. We read W.E. Du Bois and Histories of the South and had an incredible curriculum to study and try to absorb. But the story I wanted to tell was this. I worked in Moss Point in Pascagoula on the Gulf Coast, which was a little different than other areas of the state. And we had a young English woman with us on holiday, and she had been writing letters that were sent from the Midwest to her family in London saying what a good time she was having in Minnesota. So we were all arrested one day, and we were in jail in Pascagoula, and we were in a cell next to a bunch of white kids, local white kids. And they got on with us until they realized we were what they call COFOs. And then they began filling little cups of cold water and throwing it over the partition. It didn't really amount to that much. But when we got our one phone call to make, when you're in jail, you do get that, and they generally abided by that.
Mm-hmm.
She called Reuters, the young woman from England on holiday. She called Reuters. She said she was on hunger strike in jail in Mississippi in Pascagoula, and somehow what came out in the newspaper the next day in London was that the cell was being flooded with cold water and she was on hunger strike and she was in jail in Mississippi.
That was smart, calling Reuters. I guess you could use your one phone call to call your mother and cry, or you could call Reuters and bring the attention of the world.
And that's what she did. And so her father, who was a sort of a well-to-do businessman, called the town of Moss Point, where our project was centered, and talked to the mayor. And he became an honored guest of the town of Moss Point. The mayor had him on radio, where he apologized for his daughter. He stayed for free in the mayor's motel. And he said he would take her back, but she wouldn't go. So that's my one story, but the stories abound, and it was an
Indeed.
Incredible, incredible experience. Changed my life.
Mary, thank you so
much. Lots of wonderful things happened there.
Thank you so much. And listeners, who else was there in Freedom Summer in 1964? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. As we acknowledge the 50th anniversary with historian Peniel Joseph and your calls, and we're going to have a special surprise guest joining us, too, in just a couple of minutes. But, Peniel, I want to read part of a letter from one of the White Northern volunteers, Martha Honey, who happens to be the mother of Brian Lehrer Show producer Jody Avergan. And she wrote this letter to a friend of hers the night of Cheney's funeral. We've posted it in full on our website through our connections. And I'm just going to excerpt a few lines here. She wrote, "As a White Northerner, I can get involved whenever I feel like it and run home whenever I get bored or frustrated or scared." And she adds, I am angry because I have a choice as to whether or not to work in the movement, and I am playing upon that choice and leaving here. And what is making it worse is that all those damn Northerners are thinking of me as a brave hero. Does that give you chills when you hear it? And what do you want to say about the dynamic between the people who actually had to live that discrimination in the South and the relatively privileged white Northerners who were coming down to help temporarily?
Well, that's a beautiful sentiment, and I think she's spot on. I think one of the things that, you know, all the callers have been really brilliant, but Freedom Summer is really a hinge point in history. And one of the things that you do see is that there are these reverberations for blacks and whites. The reverberations for whites include volunteers like Mario Savio, who is a Freedom Summer volunteer and then is going to start the free speech movement in Berkeley that fall. The reverberations for blacks in many cases are going to be much different because we're going to see real disappointment and disillusionment after the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, which is coming out of Freedom Summer, is rejected at the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City. Fannie Lou Hamer makes her famous speech before the Credentials Committee. And this is right on the heels of the funeral of James Chaney, which is August 7th. And I think the bodies are found August 4th. So there is this notion of white privilege, right? But there also is this notion of racial integration, which is this really beautiful notion, and this notion of interracial activism. And I think one thing we have to say, too, Brian, is that when we think about the Freedom Summer volunteers, there is a huge proportion of those white volunteers who are Jewish Americans as well. So it's a really wonderful high point of black Jewish relations that has really been lost in the subsequent 50 years, but it's really a high point.
Roger in Cortland Manor. You're on WNYC. Hi, Roger.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay. You were there in 1964?
No. I wrote a biography of King and interviewed Bob Moses several times, and I wanted to point out a couple of things. The reason for bringing in, for having Mississippi Summer, was to basically to put white kids in danger because that was the only way to get the national media and the FBI involved in what was going on in Mississippi, which was extraordinarily lawless and dangerous at that time. That summer, to put it into perspective, there were 6 workers killed, not 3. And there were 35 shot, 80 beaten, 1,000 arrested, 30 buildings bombed, 35 churches burnt. The whole state was basically in revolt.
Peniel, you want to talk to Roger, compare historical notes here?
Yeah, no, I think he's exactly right. I think one of the things that we have to remember is right before Freedom Summer and really what SNCC called the Summer Project began, the state of Mississippi purchased a number of different weapons and guns. They purchased basically a tank. They warned their residents of an invasion that was coming. They spread fallacious rumors that SNCC had promised white students $10 a week and all the sex they could handle, quote unquote, to come down to Mississippi. So they basically viewed the volunteers as hippies in their minds, who were lawless, who were communists, who were drug addicts, and were trying to besmirch the reputation and the honor of the state. And they sent out rumors that many of the black students were going to try to sexually assault local white women. So it was a very, very dangerous time. And one of the things we have to balance out, though, is that when we think about freedom schools and those things that happen, there's 175 freedom school teachers that would end up teaching over 2,000 students in over 20 different communities that summer. And there's going to be 13 community centers that are set up. And one thing we should add is the Free Southern Theater, which gave musical performances and different cultural and artistic performances all throughout Mississippi that summer, which was connected to SNCC and connected to the civil rights movement as well.
Well, you mentioned how the opposition, the local opposition to these students coming down, that march. Samuel Bowers, who was the imperial wizard of the white Knights of the Ku Klux Klan in Mississippi, authorized Klan members in Neshoba County to kill some of the workers. They were, and that's the area where Schwerner was working. If you think about Bob Moses, he was brought down there by Amzie Moore, who was head of the Cleveland chapter of the NAACP. Mm-hmm. And Moore, at that point, was one of the few black leaders left in Mississippi, because others like Gus Counts, Bill Zani, and George Lee had been murdered. Lee was murdered in 63. The FBI didn't care, wouldn't do anything about it.
And in fact, let me play a piece of historical audio that we found on a remarkable hour-long NBC News documentary that aired at the time, and we've linked to this. It's on YouTube. We've linked to it on our site at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. This is unbelievable, from Ross Barnett, former governor of Mississippi. He was governor in 1964. Listen to what he has to say.
And it's pitiful that parents haven't trained their children in the way that they should have. They ought to stay at home and work. They ought to stay at home and tend to their own business. We will treat anyone with great respect here in Mississippi. Anyone who comes here, as long as they do not disobey our laws. But we will treat the people who come here, these children, like any other backward children should be treated.
We will treat these children like any other backward children should be treated. And to clarify, he was already a former governor of Mississippi at that time in 1964. But was that a veiled murder threat, Peniel Joseph?
Well, yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we see there is that even though, yes, the FBI and the attention of the world becomes riveted once Schwerner and Goodman are killed, everybody's lives were still in danger. And there was really the idea of white supremacy in Mississippi was considered tradition. It was considered part of the culture. So certainly those folks were threatened. And I think one of the interesting things when we think about Freedom Summer is the fact that the second congressional district director of the Delta was Stokely Carmichael. And this is Stokely Carmichael before Black Power. There's all these white workers and volunteers under him. There's people like black SNCC activists like Judy Richardson in Greenwood. Bob Zellner is the director in Greenwood, and Stokely's the second congressional district director. So it's a time of great unity. So you think to yourself, 2 years later, Carmichael's going to be screaming for black power, but in 64, he's not. In 64, he's actually working with these interracial groups of folks trying to register people, trying to get small-d democracy in Mississippi. So it's a really interesting time period that we kind of write out of history if we don't think to ourselves. It's a very unified time, even though there's all this tension because of what they're facing.
And Roger, thank you for your call and chiming in with your understanding of history. So let's talk specifically about the murder of James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner. Chaney was black from Meridian, Mississippi. Schwerner and Goodman were both from the New York area, Goodman from the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And that NBC News documentary also included clips of parents of both missing boys. I guess one body had been found, and that's why the other two were still considered missing. Peniel Joseph, is that right?
I think so.
And so here is Ms. Ben Chaney, mother of James Chaney, talking to a reporter.
How did you feel about his getting involved in a civil rights movement?
Well, when he first, I didn't think nothing about it when he first started. But after he was in Canton for a while and told me, he came home and told me about how it was and everything, then we discussed it, and he told me, he said, well, Mother, that's what I want to do. He said, because this is not for me and not for you. This is for all, for everybody.
What kind of a boy is your son?
He's a nice, marvelous child, and he brave. Whatever he went for it with all his mind and heart. He wasn't afraid.
Wasn't afraid. And here is Carolyn Goodman, Andrew Goodman's mother.
We both knew he was going into a dangerous situation, and we both knew that there were things that he was going to have to face, and, we just embraced each other as he was about to leave. We both are quite desperate to hear from him. I don't have to tell you that we're heartbroken and want more than anything in the whole world to hear from our son.
Goodman, Chaney, and Schwerner, to clarify, all three of them were missing at that moment. Those were clips that NBC obtained of two of the parents at that time. And we are joined now for a few minutes by a very special guest, David Goodman, Andrew Goodman's brother, who heads the Andrew Goodman Foundation. David is in Mississippi this week for ceremonies honoring the Freedom Summer. And David Goodman, thanks so much for joining us. Hello from New York.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. And you're right, I've been in Mississippi. I'm actually today in Atlanta, Georgia. 2 seconds ago, I had to step out. I was with Congressman John Lewis, who's dedicating the Center for Civil and Human Rights. It was quite an emotional event because Lisa McNair was there. She's the sister of Denise McNair, who was killed and murdered in the Birmingham church in 1963. And I was also with the Liuzzo daughters, whose mother came from Chicago and was shot point blank by the Ku Klux Klan, a white woman, for driving around people at the March on Selma to Montgomery. And it was a fantastic gathering. But thank you for inviting me on your show.
What did you think when you heard your mother's voice there from 1964?
Well, you know, it was at a time when they were still missing. And we had no idea that, or at least I didn't. I was 17. My brother was 3 years older, that anyone could murder somebody because they won the vote. Now, I mean, you can say I was naive. I think it was just a matter of unconscious state of mind. And I think most of the white country, if you didn't live in the South, didn't appreciate how dangerous it was for people to stand up against the tremendous resistance and to keep a way of life which we call today racist and un-American, but that's not how the people who were upholding it saw it. So she was missing a son, and it was a personal tragedy, but it was also an American story and an American tragedy.
Your mother recently wrote a book about this, didn't she?
Well, yeah, she passed away in 2007, and for 20 years she was trying to put down her thoughts in terms of her life in the context of the movement, the human dignity, social justice, civil rights movement in our country, of which she was a part of well before my brother was murdered. And she wrote it in conjunction with a fellow by the name of Brad Herzog. Fortunately, it was finished before she passed away.
The book is called My Mantelpiece, correct?
That's correct.
Now, one of the things that people may not remember about the event, if they ever knew it, is that many people claimed it was a hoax or a publicity stunt. In fact, here is a historical clip of President Johnson talking at the time, again, your brother was still missing, with Mississippi Senator James Eastland. This is from the White House archives.
Jim, we've got 3 kids missing down there. What can I do about it?
Well, I don't know. I don't believe there's 3 missing. Now, I'm going to tell you why I don't think there's a damn thing to it. They were put in jail in Philadelphia, in East Mississippi, right next to county, right next to John Stennis's home county. And they were going to Meridian. There's not a Ku Klux Klan in that area. There's not a citizen's council in that area. There's no organized white man in that area. So that's why I think it's a publicity stunt.
Did you ever hear that clip before, David?
Yes, I did. It's pretty stunning. However, if you understand the spirit of the times from the point of view of the power structure, they just wanted to sweep this under the rug and see it go away. Eastland knew they were dead.
He knew they were dead?
Absolutely. There's no question in my mind. I mean, you couldn't live in Mississippi and understand that culture without understanding what would happen to a person. I mean, if you disappeared, they're assumed dead. That's what everybody from Mississippi told me, who was alive and still alive at the time. And we just didn't understand that people could be that way. I got to tell you, again, I'm saying it may seem naive, but that's the way it was.
And it, I guess, is even more galling to hear in that clip that he denied that there was Klan in that area, in the Meridian area, and they were, in fact, killed by Klan members in that area. Correct?
Well, that's right. Yeah, of course. I mean, they knew, not only did all the elected politicians know where the Klan was concentrated, but they knew that certain parts of the South were more violent than the others, and it has to do with a long story around who settled the area, and a lot of the people in that part of Mississippi were bootleggers, and they didn't like the government. They didn't see any points for law. They took care of law themselves, and this was just a custom and habit. So it's consistent with decades, maybe centuries, of the social structure there, and when they didn't like somebody, they meaning the Klan and members of the Klan, they'd take care of themselves in their way. And it's very hard to share that with people who aren't really aware of our history. Our country's fascinating. By the way, this story has been repeated in all parts of our country at one point, one time or another. And this is particularly painful because not only did they murder my brother, they assassinated the Constitution of the United States.
Peniel, Joseph, anything you want to say to David also, Goodman?
Oh, no, Dave, I think he's definitely doing heroic work, and I'm sorry for your loss. I think that local authorities were also implicated in the murder of Andy Goodman and Mickey Schwerner and James Chaney in terms of Deputy Sheriff Cecil Price and others who at times faced legal charges as well in terms of the implication of the disappearance and the subsequent murder of those three civil rights workers.
And David Goodman, thank you so much for giving us some time today as you acknowledge the loss of your brother in that murder 50 years ago yesterday. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's get a couple of more oral history calls on from some of you, remembering your participation in Freedom Summer 1964 with historian Peniel Joseph. Deborah in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hello, Deborah.
Thank you very much. I have a very personal memory. I was 9 years old in 1964, and my Texas-born bred parents were living in a state just north of the Mason-Dixon. My mother was a high school librarian, and the topic of the passing of the Civil Rights Act had been active for nearly a year in my little town. You know, the House of Representatives passed it in February 10, and then the Senate on June 10th, and then the President Johnson signed it into law July 2nd. And because my mother's in public and her support of it, we had gangs of men and boys driving past our house soon after July 2nd for several days and weeks, and they would throw rocks and eggs at our house, and it culminated sometime in July. In August, with a tree on our property at night being set aflame, and people were shouting and yelling, and the fire truck came and the police, because you looked and there was a person hanging on the tree, that someone had been lynched and torched on the tree. And so they put out the tree, and blessedly, it was someone who'd been lynched and torched in effigy, a life-size figure. But there was a sign near the tree with a name on it, and it had my mother's name on it. Those men lynched and burned my mother in effigy because of their support of the passage of the Civil Rights Act and speaking out on that. And
my God.
Freedom Summer 64.
How has that affected you through your life?
Well, profoundly, because then 12 years later, at the age of 21, I found myself in the middle of the cotton patch teaching in a little school in Clarksdale, Mississippi. And I also found myself working 3 days a week in Parchman, teaching adult basic ed and GED to women in the women's camp in Mississippi State Penitentiary. And we would pass Fullville 3 times a week where Ms. Hamer lived, going to and from Parchman from Foxdale. And that year Ms. Hamer died. She died March 14th, 1977. She was 59, and she died of breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't any commotion or notice or anything about her passing locally. It was like some ordinary person had passed on. Mm.
Deborah, thank you so much for your memories. It sounds like a tough day for you. Hang in there. Thank you for sharing it with us. Margot Adler, NPR News correspondent, calling in with a memory. Hey, Margot.
Hi there, Brian.
So where were you in the summer?
I was actually in 65, the year afterwards. I was a friend of the Goodman family and also had been at Berkeley, a free speech movement veteran, and so I saw Mario Sarvi and others get real leadership skills. So I went down to one of the worst places in Mississippi, Belzoni in Humphrey County. And even after that whole first year, there had been no one registered. I think it's very hard to understand the palpable fear that really was everywhere. When you got people to agree to register the next day and you came for them, they suddenly had to see the doctor or they suddenly were not there at all. And it's really hard for people growing up now to realize how much poverty there was. I was living in a house in which there was no running water. There was an outhouse outside with pigs running around. We brushed our teeth by basically, you know, over the fence, essentially with a glass of water. There was no sewage at all. So when it rained, it was incredible. And there were no doctors, no doctors. So when you knocked on people's doors, basically the number of sick people who hadn't seen anyone was just, I mean, it was just amazing. And we were, in a sense, as white students, we were, in a sense, hostages, because without us, just so many people would just get killed and no one would notice. But if a white student who was like a senator's, you know, daughter or something got killed, someone would notice, you know? And the other thing that I would like to say, the last thing is also that I was, in the last days I was there, I and a group of five of us went in a car and we got lost on a lonely plantation. And after we had seen these people to talk to them about registering, White Citizens Council started following us on this lonely plantation. And we got lost and we were suddenly at a dead end and they came to us. And basically, all the guys, which was everybody but me, they told the one African-American guy to go into the cornfields and disappear. And then the white students, every one of them was beat up, and I was just left in the car. And then the next day, when we went to the police, you know, and tried to, or the FBI, to try to help, you know, this is why Mississippi Birding is such a false movie. Basically, we went to them, and what their response was, that they took the 18-year-old kid that was in our group and marched him down to the draft board.
Wow. Did it take some special courage on your part to go down there in 1965, the year after Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney? You knew what the risks were.
I knew what the risks were, and, you know, I knew the family, and I don't know, but I had been, you know, I had such an experience in the free speech movement where we had achieved victory that I felt very encouraged by that. And at the end of that summer, only 7 people were registered in Belzoni. But then the voting rights happened and suddenly everything changed.
Margot, thank you so much for chiming in. Great to hear your voice and an amazing set of memories from NPR's Margot Adler on Freedom Summer 1964. And historian Peniel Joseph from Tufts University and author of Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama. To finish up on her last point, not that many people got registered in what was billed as this voter registration drive for African Americans in Mississippi. I know it started with something crazy low, like 6% of eligible black voters registered, but it didn't end with that many either, did it?
No, it didn't. And when we think about Freedom Summer, it's not going to be all about just voter registration, because until the Voting Rights Act is passed in August of 1965, the protections to force registration aren't there. So what it's really about is civic education through the freedom schools that people like Charlie Cobb and others start. People like Stokely Carmichael, Bob Moses are teaching in. It's a civic education, and it's also voting political power through the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party that's coming out of Freedom Summer. Very quickly, June, July, August are very incredible, because during Freedom Summer and 2 weeks after James Cheney's funeral, the Democratic National Convention convenes in Atlantic City, and hundreds of folks from Freedom Summer are bused to Atlantic City, including Fannie Lou Hamer. And what they do is they're on the boardwalk and inside of the convention. And Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman, there's huge placards and posters, and people are marching up and down the Atlantic City boardwalk, and they're trying to be seated. The Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party is trying to unseat the all-white delegation of the state of Mississippi that's not allowing African-American inclusion. And Lyndon Johnson personally makes sure that the MFDP and Mrs. Hamer are not allowed to be seated. They're offered a compromise of two non-voting delegates. They reject that compromise. And that's really going to set in motion some of the splits that we're going to see in the movement. Within 2 years, Carmichael is calling for black power in Mississippi. A lot of the root of that is in Atlantic City and during Freedom Summer. And Mrs. Hamer does her famous Credentials Committee testimony where she says, "Is this America? The land of the free and the home of the brave, where we're beaten for wanting to live like decent human beings."
Well, people on our comments page are posting that we need a new Freedom Summer, that voting rights are still under attack. So that's another conversation to keep having. But we will keep having historian Peniel Joseph from time to time through sometime into next year to talk about the 50th anniversaries of these various mileposts in the civil rights movement. Peniel, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to all of you who called in with your Freedom Summer oral histories. Desegregation, mass participation, unification, do things gradually, will bring more tragedy. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we've been through racial politics today, four Supreme Court decisions, two Chris Christie scandals, and the undetermined Rangel-Espaillat outcome. And we conclude for our last 2 minutes with a few minutes with the question, are you a date Googler, or do you practice Google abstinence? Maybe you saw Maureen O'Connor's column in New York Magazine about why it might be better not to research your love interests online. So, callers, do you Google your dates? If you do, what do you discover? 212-433-WNYC. Or maybe more importantly, what are you hoping to find? What would be a deal breaker? Tell us your Googling your date stories. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And do you do it? Do you not do it? Did you do it but feel creepy about it? 212-433-9692. And if you don't, as many of Maureen O'Connor's friends don't, what are you wary of? Is the better way to fan the flames of budding romance to actually get to know the person in person? What does that add to the early stages of a relationship for you? 212-433-9692. Maureen O'Connor, columnist for New York Magazine. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Could you set this up for us? You and your friend got into an argument.
Yes, we did. So my friend had been on a few dates with a guy, and he'd sort of mentioned, "Oh, have you watched my comedy videos on YouTube?" And she goes, "No, I want to get to know you in person." So she told me this. We were G-chatting, actually, at work, obviously, because this is how we spend our days. And I was like, it was so shocking to me, the idea that she could know this was out there. And of all things to sort of be, I don't know, indicative of a person and his, like, life, his comedy of all things, to refuse to avail yourself to that knowledge almost made me angry. And I was like, well, you have to do it. And then I started Googling him, and I morphed into this, like, in this, like, Garden of Eden of her Google. I was the snake, and I was like, you must look at these things. And then I started asking around, and I realized that a lot of my friends who are less nosy than I am were saying, well, no, because if you look at it, then it's going to mess up your understanding of him. It'll be prejudicial, or you don't want to get too wrapped up in it. So I try to hold back. And they all sort of talked about it almost with the language we associate with chastity, that they say, you know, it's really tempting, but I need to resist. I'm trying to wait until I know him a little better and we're really comfortable with each other.
I'm saving my Googling for marriage.
Exactly.
But you wrote in your column that you know someone who abstained from Googling a guy, but when she eventually did, she discovered he was married.
Well, here's the key. She discovered page after page of wedding photos. And of course, you know, for people that have married in the sort of age of Pinterest, there's this infinite that is like every, you know, the wedding photographer had a page with their names on it. The, you know, the person who designed the place cards had photos of it with their names on it. And we go through this and everybody's looking at it and they're like, oh, my God, what do we do? And as it turned out, the guy was divorced, married and divorced relatively quickly. And it was extraordinarily odd that, you know, you might not talk about your exes on a first date, but all of a sudden we're looking at this wedding. And the funny thing is some girls were like, oh, wow, that's a really bad, he's divorced, he didn't tell you. All I could say was, well, look what a lovely groom he was. Maybe you should be with this man. So lovely.
Elaine in Hoboken, you're on WNYC. Hi, Elaine.
Hi, yeah, I did Google the guy I'm dating now because he told me his wife died, so I looked up his last name in the obituary to make sure.
Ooh.
And I did find, I found her there, so it was good to go, because the previous person who got my phone number at the gym, when I went to Google him, I found his mugshot, and he had stabbed his previous girlfriend and his lawyer, according to the allegation. So that's why I say absolutely, and I raised a daughter who's an adult now, so because of that, I learned for personal safety reasons, it's good to Google if you're female especially, or, but I guess anybody could have a potentially violent partner. You want to know that.
I wish you could see that Maureen's jaw dropped from the eighth floor that we're on to about the third floor of this building when you said mugshot.
Yeah, it's so true because on one hand, a lot of people did say that. They're like, is it even safe to see somebody without Googling them? Which is sort of, it's a funny, it's almost that like you can find out information that can be really important. On the other hand, you can't know for sure that a person is going to be, you know, nonviolent because you don't find a mugshot in his, you know, it gives you a sense of security and it can tell you sort of negative information, but it's hard to know whether you're getting, you know, the inverse of that.
Then there was, of course, all of history until 10 years ago when people couldn't do this. Kate in Manhattan and Paul in Jersey City, both on here. Kate, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hi there.
And Paul, you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So I think we're going to have a little people's note comparing here. Kate, what do you do?
What do I do? I'm a brand strategist, but so a full-time GS student doing an undergraduate degree at Columbia.
Oh, I really meant you Google your dates.
Oh, I certainly Google my dates. For advertising agencies, and so online search, as far as I'm concerned, is like new business. And is about building a profile on anyone who you might date, whether it's online or not. And that, and clearly, in terms of a world that's about transparency and data, I would look at everything from marriage, jobs, wealth and assets, divorce, and particularly published photos.
Before you go on your first date? You need all that before you go to lunch with somebody?
Not lunch. Well, I mean, you know, if you use the analogy of new business, which is all from a commercial perspective, which is about knowing your prospect, as far as I'm concerned, one has to know one's prospect from a dating perspective.
Right. Okay, and you know what? Your phone line is breaking up so bad that I'm going to have to let you go. But Paul in Jersey City, you're on the other side of this as a personal practice?
I guess I am. I do not Google much of anything because I feel like I'd like to get to know the person. And the more you know about a person before you go out with them, I feel like you might be guiding the conversation in a certain direction that it would not have otherwise gone. And you might be answering questions that you would have answered otherwise instead of just honestly and whatever comes to mind when you're having a conversation.
Paul, thank you. I'm going to go to Julia in Greenpoint next. Julia, you're on WNYC. Hey.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a big fan.
Thank you.
I have sort of a different perspective, and that is that a couple years ago, an ex of mine put a profile of me on a dating website called Dating Psychos. And it has my name, picture of me, my phone number, my business name, my address. and everything. So now my fear for the rest of my life is that people are going to Google me. I mean, actually, I'm getting married in 2 weeks, so I guess I don't have to worry about that, future dates. But,
let's hope.
You know, this thing is just always there on the Internet now. So I'm very against Googling future dates and past dates for that reason. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And there's history of people Googling her.
Yeah, yes, definitely.
So looking at it from the point of view of the Googlee instead of the Googler.
That's what I found, too, that one of my friends was saying that I don't Google people because he's like, I'm just hoping that they aren't Googling me because I don't like what's there for me. So for him, he's like, it's karma that he's hoping. Let's hope if I don't do it, then they won't either.
Lisa in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I think the Internet means that we don't have backstories of people. I recently was talking with a guy, and we were going to go out, and he asked me to look at a PowerPoint presentation, and the properties had his real name in it, and I did Google him and found out he was married with 3 children. And I felt weird doing it, but I was really glad I did because he was married and very married.
So, Maureen,
yeah.
I mean, you know, I mean, maybe, Lisa, thank you. And so now we've had the guy with the mugshot and the guy who's really married with 3 kids. And even though this is going to be probably, we hope, a small minority of all the dating experiences that people have, one argument for Googling is that you will at least weed out that small percentage of criminals and psychopathic bigamists.
You know, that's actually what happened when years ago when the U.S. congressman from upstate New York, Chris Lee, ended up resigning, and after he'd sent, you know, pictures of himself shirtless to a woman, the woman Googled him and realized, oh, my God, he's a congressman. And that was when she, you know, reached out and was like, does anyone want to tell this story? And in fact, we did.
How are you, Anthony? Kofi in Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thanks.
Absolutely love your show.
Thank you
very
much.
I'm addicted to it. I listen to it all the time.
It's a positive addiction.
Yep.
What's your story?
So I had an experience where once I met a girl, and we exchanged Instagrams. So I think it still kind of falls into Googling someone, right, because it's essentially just kind of doing our own version of background checking, checking their social media, et cetera.
Right,
so,
yeah.
Our experience was that we exchanged each other's Instagram in person, and while we were both still there, I was going through her Instagram and she was going through my timeline, and we were having a conversation about it, where she's traveled, where I have traveled, what restaurants we've been to, what foods we cook, etc. And it was a very real and current moment because we were kind of stalking each other, but in person, and we could get more detailed information about it. So,
I love this. This is the Googling each other date.
It's the like it's the cyber bionic date. You know, you're enhancing your reality with your internet self too.
Exactly.
This picture of you, was this like sophomore year when, you know, you're kind of in the bath? Oh, never mind. Okay. Kofi, thank you very much. That's a great story. So, Maureen, the premise of your article was that you were having this argument with your friend, and you were pro-Googling, and she was anti-Googling your dates. Mm-hmm. Have you come around now to Google abstinence?
You know, I see some of the wisdom of it. I think I'm far too nosy. Although my new theory now is that I tell everybody, you don't have to Google your date. Just give me his name and I'll Google him. And if he has a serial killer, I'll just, you know, I'll tell you if you need to know.
And we will wrap it up with this comment from our webpage. Somebody wrote, I Googled my boyfriend because he is a New Yorker cartoonist, and I couldn't possibly date a guy whose cartoons I didn't think were funny. Luckily, I love them, and we've been together for 10 years. And that's the last word. We thank Maureen O'Connor, columnist for New York Magazine, who wrote about Googling your dates versus Google abstinence. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.